Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies at Boston University. Speaking will be author Gregory Maguire. Mr. Maguire's lecture is titled, The Witch of Endor, Reading the Future. We begin with an introduction by Luce Program Director Peter Hawkins.
Since our startup in 2000, the Luce Program has developed courses in the College of Arts and Sciences, sponsored lectures, readings, and performances, and organized two previous interdisciplinary conferences, one on the Song of Songs, another on Ruth. Out of it all came Scrolls of Love, a collection of essays published by Fordham University Press, co-edited by Leslie Cushing Stahlberg and me. Leslie and I wanted to continue our Bible and literature collaboration after she finished her doctoral work here at BU and then took up a position at Colgate University. Because she was beginning a book on the wives of King David, only three of whom I could name, and certainly none of whom exactly preoccupy the authors of 1 and 2 Samuel, I wondered what would happen if we organized a conference around the female characters in the Hebrew Bible that most people don't know. Figures who may not get much airtime in Scripture, but who nonetheless have acquired a legacy in biblical commentary, in literature, in the visual arts, and in music. The matriarchs have been given their due. But what about the minor players in the bit parts? What about wives, daughters, sisters, and women whose names, if once remembered, have either been forgotten or suppressed? To describe these figures, we came up with the phrase, or I did, I take full responsibility, of Little Women, which at first we used entirely between ourselves, and then it just stuck. We mean no disrespect to these characters. Instead, we want to play with the notion of scant mention and abundant interpretation. Little women who have big stories. It took no time at all to decide how to open the conference. Ever since Gregory Maguire's visit to the Luce Program, when he gave us a marvelous lecture on A Few Wicked Years that began with reminiscences about his own, shall we say, misfortunate beginnings as an altar boy, and then his wonderful career as a director of backyard performances of The Wizard of Oz. Ever since then, he was, as far as I and Christine were concerned, a marked man. Who could possibly be a better choice to raise up the Witch of Endor from obscurity than the author of Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, 1995, or its sequel, Son of a Witch, 2005. Countering the admonition of Exodus 22:18, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, Maguire has done more to enliven Elphaba and her kind than anyone else. She of Endor, perhaps the only kind person in all of Deuteronomist history, she would find her eloquent expounder at last. And we, I hope, a preview of Maguire's work in progress, Deposition of an Oracle. Without further ado, then, let me welcome Gregory Maguire back to Boston University as he speaks to us about The Witch of Endor, Reading the Future. Gregory Maguire.
Well, thank you very much. I am an unlikely candidate to speak at this gathering of wise and lettered people. I am not a scholar of religion. I am not a scholar, period. I'm a Catholic, so I know very little about the Bible. I am plagued by faith and blessed with doubt in roughly equal measure. But that doesn't make me qualified to speak about the Witch of Endor, nor indeed about any other part of the Bible. And that includes the title page, and the glossy illustrations, and even the tear-out advertisements in the back for penitential whips and correcting chains, and for hair shirts brought out this season in the latest contemporary style, a kind of thong. that can make one deeply regret just about every thought that crosses one's mind, including agreeing to speak about anyone in the Bible at all. But I am easily coerced by kind people, so I find myself worrying over The Witch of Endor and wondering why I agreed to do this. What do I know from The Witch of Endor? Wasn't that the name of the mother of the suburban housewife on TV's Bewitched? Samantha Stevens' mother? No, that was Endora. At the very least, The Witch of Endor is a term that I recognize, though I can't remember why. She lives in a cubbyhole in my memory, in a sector I rarely visit, since I don't play Trivial Pursuit. In my mind, The Witch of Endor is a quirky little figurine, like a 1950s plastic cowboy, standing in plastic sandals on a plastic puddle all of her own, gathering dust. She has a hooded cloak. No doubt she has a staff. I mean, a big walking stick, not a collection of administrative assistants. And she gives herself up to malice and bewitchery, which leaves her precious little time to devote to the care of her hair. Near her, in my mental cubby, are the Delphic Oracle, and the Witch of Thessaly, and Circe from the Odyssey, and Cassandra from the Iliad. They are all seers and busybodies from before the Christian era. They have nothing to do with one another, except that's all whom I can summon up, with all my powers of summary, without doing a doctorate on the matter. They have some things in common with one another, and some things in common with several other witches of my acquaintance, particularly Elphaba, the Wicked Witch of the West. Though born of different traditions, they share the commonality of their gender, something that they don't share with me, which gives me the chance to be ignorant, curious, and up to a point, objective. But, as I gently screamed to the conference organizers over the phone, I am a novelist first and foremost. I am ill-equipped to consider a religious figure. What do I know about prophecy or the Witch of Endor? You'll find out, they murmured prophetically. Quite sensibly, mistrusting my powers of research, they reminded me that the Witch of Endor's story is told in the first book of Samuel. Yes, they admitted, she is a witch, a necromancer. Since I have been accused of rehabilitating the Wicked Witch of the West, they thought, I might dash off a hagiography of the Witch of Endor, in between translating the lost nursery rhymes of Joseph Stalin and penning the libretto for the forthcoming musical comedy version of The Silence of the Lambs. Finally, I got it. What I had done for the Wicked Witch of the West and the Wicked Witch of the East, they hoped I might do for the Wicked Witch of the Middle East. I accepted the job primarily because this year I have found myself struggling over writing a novel about an oracle, a seer, if you will, a prophet, a reader of auguries. Perhaps I thought if I obliged myself to study The Witch of Endor, I might find a clue as to the destiny of my own oracular protagonist, and I might jostle myself out of this state of paralysis. So I advised the Loose program to advertise my remarks as follows. Using the Hebrew Bible reference to the Witch of Endor and her prophecies to King Saul about his imminent death, novelist Gregory Maguire will consider the correlation of prophecy and sympathy in the Book of Samuel story and other sources, including his own work in progress, blah, 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 blah. So you see, I was being entirely selfish in accepting this invitation, and now all of you have to suffer. This should put the tin hat on your ever asking me again, Peter. Therefore, with your permission, I will begin not with The Witch of Endor, but with the opening several pages of the work in progress. It's called Deposition of an Oracle. It concerns Yackel, who served as a kind of oracle in the life of Elphaba, the Wicked Witch of the West, and in the life of her son, Lear. The time came for her to die, and she would not die. So perhaps she might waste away, they thought, and she did waste, but not away. And the time came for her to receive final absolution, so they set candles upon her clavicle, but this she would not allow. She blasphemed with gusto, and she knocked the scented oils across the shroud they'd readied on a trestle nearby. God love her, they said, in bitter, unconvincing voices. Or perhaps they meant, may the unnamed God love her, our unrepentant sister Yackel, for we certainly can't. Sink me in the crypt, she said, speaking for the first time in a dozen years. You're too young to know. That's how they used to do it. When the time came for an elder to go, and she wouldn't, they settled her with a couple of candles and a bottle of wine down in the ossuary so she could chummy up to the bones and get used to the notion. They came back a year later to sweep up the leavings. "Mercy," said whoever was nearby to hear. "I insist," she replied. "Check with Sister Scholastica, and she'll bear me out."
"She's raving mad," said someone else, chocolately.
Yackel approved of chocolate, and indeed everything edible. Since Yackel's eyesight had gone out for good a decade earlier, she identified individuals by the degree and idiosyncrasy of their halitosis.
"She's always been raving mad," said a third observer,
vinegarish almonds.
"Isn't that rather sweet?"
Yackel reached for something to throw, and all she could find was her other hand, which wouldn't detach.
"She's doing sign language."
"The poor, deluded devlet."
"Clinging to life so. Whatever for?" "Perhaps it isn't her time."
"It is," said Yackel. "It is. I keep telling you. Won't you fiends let me die? I want to go to hell in a handbasket. Put me out of my misery and into the afterlife where I can do some real damage, damn it."
"She's not herself," said someone.
"She never was reliably herself, to hear tell," said another. The bedsheets caught fire spontaneously. Yackel found she was rather enjoying this, but it helped neither her reputation nor her rescue that the only liquid nearby with which to douse the flames was cognac. Yackel wasn't to be dissuaded. "Is there still a superior in the house?" she asked. "Someone who can lay down the law?"
"The superior Mott died a decade ago," they replied.
"We work by consensus now. We've noted your request to be interred alive. We'll put it on the agenda and take it up next week at council."
"She'll burn the house down, and us with it," muttered a novice.
Sometime later, Yackel could hear that the innocent voice echoed in spareness. "Come here, my ducky," said Yackel, grasping. "I smell a little peppermint girl nearby, and no garlicky matron hovering. Are you the sentry? On our own, are we? Come, sit nearer. Surely there is still a sister apothecary in residence, with her cabinets of nostrums and Beckhams, tonics and tablets. She must possess a sealed jar. It would be dark blue glass, pasted over with a label featuring three sets of crossed tibias. Couldn't you find this and pour me out a fatal little decoction?"
"Not a spoonful of it. I ain't the grace to do it," said Peppermint Girl. "Leave go of me, you harpy. Let go, or I'll bite you."
Out of charity to the young, Yackel let go. It would do the poor girl no good to take a bite of old Yackel. The antidote ain't been invented yet, etc. Hours and days pass at elastic rhythms for the blind. Whether the pattern of her naps and wakings follow the ordinary interruptions of daylight by nighttime, Yackel couldn't tell. But a visit from Broccoli Breath informed her eventually that the sorority had decided to bow to Yackel's final wish. They would install her on a bier in the crypt, among the ancient remains of women long dead. She could approach bodily corruption at whatever speed appealed to her. 3 candles, and as to nourishment, red or white. "A beaker of gasoline and a match as a chaser," said Yackel, but she was indulging in a joke. She was that pleased. She nominated a saucy persimmon flacon and a beeswax candle scented with lime berries, for the aroma, not for the light. She was beyond light now.
"Good voyage, eldest soul," they sang to her as they carried her down the stairs.
Though she weighed no more than spun sugar brittle, she was awkward to move. She couldn't govern her own arms or legs. As if motivated by a cantankerousness independent of her own, her limbs would keep ratcheting out to jab into door jams. The procession lacked a fitting dignity. "Don't come down for at least a year," she sang out, giddy as a lambkin. "Make that 2. I might be old as sin itself, but once I start rotting, it won't be pretty. If I hammer at the cellar door, don't open it. I'm probably just collecting for some public charity in hell."
"Can we serenade you with an epithalamium as you go to marry death?"
asked one of the bearers, tucking in the shroud to make it cozy. "Save your doggy breath. Go. Go on to the rest of your lives, you lot. It's been a swell, mysterious mess of a life. Don't mind me. I'll blow the lights out before I lower my own lights.
A year later, when a sister ventured into the crypt to prepare for another burial, she came across the hem of Yakel's shroud. She wept at the notion of death, until Yakel sat up and said, "What? Morning already? And I having these naughty dreams?" The Mont's tears turned to screams, and she fled upstairs to start immediately upon a long and lively career as an alcoholic. You can imagine the writer's block that might set in by my starting a novel intuitively like this. What happens next to an oracle who won't die? But before we leave behind my own creative paralysis, I want to quote you just two short paragraphs from Wicked, where the Wicked Witch of the West considers the problem of divine influence in matters of political power and nation building, the subject, after all, of the story of King Saul. This from Wicked, in which the Wicked Witch of the West ruminates, quote, "For who was in thrall to whom, really? And could it ever be known? Each agent working in collusion and antagonism, like the cold and the sun alike creating a deadly spear of ice. Was the wizard a charlatan, a fraud, a despot of merely human power and failure? And Madame Marrable and Yakel, was there any connection? Were they the same person? Were they harsh divinities, avatars of a power of darkness? Were they poisonous flitches struck from the evil body of the Cumbric witch? Or were they singly or together, old Cumbricia herself, or such as could be presumed to have survived from the heroic age of mythology into these crabbed, cramped modern days? Did they govern the wizard, jerk him about like a marionette? Who is in thrall to whom?" So, here we get to the operative words that bind Yakel and the Wicked Witch of the West and the Witch of Endor and Cassandra and the Witch of Thessaly and the Delphic Oracle and the part of the psychic Oda Mae Brown, played by Whoopi Goldberg in the film called Ghost. Who is in thrall to whom is a valid question, both in terms of divine providence and psychological influence. I turn to the Old Testament to reread the first book of Samuel and to remind myself of what I had once known from seventh grade Catholic school religion classes. It is impossible to consider the Witch of Endor without reviewing the lives of King Saul and the prophet Samuel. So here is a potted chronicle, a somewhat irreverent gallop through sacred history. Forgive me in advance. The first book of Samuel begins with the birth of this Old Testament prophet named Samuel. My Bible asserts that Samuel's leadership and that of his sons represents a semi-republican government. But the book of Samuel is a book about transitions. For while old Samuel is a prophet, one who gets his marching orders directly from the Lord and sees visions that always turn out to be true, the book of Samuel is also about the corruption of leadership by blind and deluded national leaders. Samuel was a wise leader, but his sons were not. Sons are often not as wise leaders as their fathers. The prophet's sons, assert the first book of Samuel, walked not in his ways. So the elders of Israel asked Samuel to establish for them a monarchy instead, if you don't mind. The Lord was displeased and made his opinion known to Samuel, who duly circulated the Lord's reservations on the matter. But the people said, "Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." So the Lord said, "Don't say I didn't warn you." Only that's not an exact translation. And the Lord allowed Samuel to make a king for the Israelites, which he did out of a choice young man and goodly named Saul. What follows in the first book of Samuel is a lot of coming and going, a timetable of battles and campaigns. Samuel tells what is about to happen in a kind of unnerving Nostradamus-esque sort of way. Samuel says to Saul, "When thou art departed from me today, then thou shalt find two men by Rachel's sepulchre, and they will say unto thee, etc., etc. And thou shalt go there and do this, and thou shalt go there and say that, and it's nothing short of spooky." Samuel is always right on the money, because he's a professional prophet, and that's what he does. Meaning no disrespect to the story in my slapdash retelling, Saul becomes king and begets Jonathan, and much lively business is said and done with people named Kish and Ner and Abner and Amalek who came up from Egypt. And it all sounds from this remove a little bit like the backstory of The Lord of the Rings. That's because the tropes of the King James Bible are so strong that they are impossible not to emulate. Samuel has some great and fearsome lines, including saying to Agag, the king of the Amalekites, "As thy sword hath made women childless, so shall thy mother be childless among women," before he hews Agag in pieces. And perhaps he is doing the Lord's work to establish the Israelites where they belong, but it's a bit messy for my taste, and triumphalist, even 3,000 years later. About halfway through the first book of Samuel, who should come on the scene but David, the wonderful David. David the shepherd, David the psalmist, a son of Jesse, that is cunning in playing on the harp, and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person, and the Lord was with him. We hear the glorious Sunday school story of David and Goliath, and David's slewing of the giant with a slingshot. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and of Judah arose and shouted. And I imagine that the point of this line is that the shout was so loud that King Saul heard it every bit as fearfully as the retreating Philistines. We know that history is with David. And so did the first audiences of the book of Samuel. The second half of the first book of Samuel, therefore, is about how Saul's initial trust in David turns into jealousy. Old King Saul, for narrative, psychological, and redemptive purposes, provides the history against which David can rise and be recognized. In the popular imagination, therefore, David is sculpted lovingly by Michelangelo and by Donatello. By comparison, Saul is reduced to seeming like one of those weather-worn, nearly anonymous kings, face and character blunted by time and the elements, standing out the millennium in some stone porch halfway up the side facade of Chartres, or Reims, or Notre Dame. Or, using contemporary metaphors from this season of the Academy Awards, David is Brad Pitt in Babel, and Saul is the cranky old man played by Alan Arkin in Little Miss Sunshine. Later on in Samuel comes the friendship of David and Jonathan. And I hope I may be permitted to say, as a 21st century gay Christian, that I can't help but see this tender romance as another part of the death of Saul, the death of the king, the passing of an epoch, which is the real subject of the first book of Samuel. And it came to pass that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would let him go no more to his own father's house. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant, because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David, and his garments, even to his sword and to his bow and to his girdle. David is therefore welcomed into Saul's house, but the women sang, quite famously, "Na na na boo boo," only that's not an exact translation. The 16th century Jacobean translators of the Bible into the English of King James rehash it as, "Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s." And it is hard to remember that they are talking about those slain in battle and not talking about being slain as in, "Oh my God, I can't breathe. Did you see that comely hunk of harpist wearing little more than a slingshot?" All Israel and Judah loved David, said the first book of Samuel. So Saul then offers one of his own two daughters as a wife to David, but David, the son of a shepherd, lacks the dowry to bring into a royal house as a son-in-law. Saul sends the message that the king desireth not any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to be avenged of the king's enemies. Hoping, of course, that, like any wicked stepmother, hoping that David will perish at the hands of the Philistines, whose foreskins he is trying to procure one way or the other. Yes, foreskins. As the late Anna Russell used to say of the plot of Wagner's Ring Cycle, "I'm not making this up." But David meets the challenge, and so Saul gives his daughter Michal to David in marriage and orders his son Jonathan to kill David. But Jonathan, a noble figure in the Bible, if there is one, and of course there is, it's the Bible, okay? Jonathan obeys his father but does not betray his best beloved, and Jonathan saves David's life. Saul later tries to slay David again, but Michal saves him this time, and David flees and meets up with Samuel, the prophet. Remember him? Some more back and forth, prophecies and threats, a real home for the holidays kind of nightmare. Mel Gibson should get his meaty hands on this story, I'm telling you. And Jonathan says unto David, "Come and let us go out into the field." And Saul's anger is now kindled against Jonathan. And the father says, "Thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion?" Note that phrase. It's the reason I've indulged myself in all this homoerotic romance. When Saul is angriest that his son is so besotted with David, he accuses him of being not his own son, but the son of a perverse, rebellious woman. That's what he says to his son, who has given all his clothes and his heart to David. Maybe if he saw, if Jonathan loved David, there'd be no line of kingly dynasty to survive him through Jonathan. Another sign of Saul's losing out in history sweepstakes. Anyway, then Saul, in that lighthearted tradition of family chronicles, tries to smite his own son with a javelin. Jonathan goes out and reunites with David, and quote, "They kissed one another and wept with one another until David exceeded." I'm not quite sure what the Jacobean translators meant by the use of the word exceeded. It is quite beyond me to imagine. David flees, and Saul gives chase, but we have to get to the Witch of Endor, don't we? So, after several more pages of smiting and fleeing and various other shenanigans, then Saul, quote, "went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats. And he came to where there was a cave, and Saul went in, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave," which appeared to fulfill one of the thousands of prophecies by which people were living in those days. And David could have killed Saul. The king was that close, but David has a big heart, and he bows himself before Saul, saying, "My lord, the king." The cave is important, so remember it, won't you? David's mercy at staying his hand when he has the chance to kill his persecutor softens the heart of Saul, who lifts up his voice and weeps. And he says to David, "Thou art more righteous than I, for thou hast rewarded me good, whereas I have rewarded thee evil." And Saul goes home, says the narrator, and the prophet Samuel dies. One has to wonder, how can the book of Samuel continue if the prophet dies halfway through? But wait, all in good time, my dears. David takes some more wives, I think, and Saul gives Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to someone else, I think. The marital arrangements outcomplicate anything from the days of our lives on daytime TV. Once again, David preserves Saul's life when he has the chance to take it. But David at last says in his heart, "I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines, and Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more in any coast of Israel." David thus departing from Israel, Saul seeks no more again for him. And David dwells in the country of the Philistines, if I am reading the return address correctly. And now we come at last to the Witch of Endor. You should know that Saul had ordered all necromancers, wizards, and those that had familiar spirits be suppressed and exiled. But the pesky Philistine host came and pitched camp nearby, and Saul was afraid, and, quote, "his heart greatly trembled. And when Saul inquired of the Lord answereth him not, neither by dreams nor by prophets." According to the King James Version, bowdlerized a little here in consideration of time, "Then said Saul unto his servants, Seek me a woman that hath a familiar spirit, that I may go to her and inquire of her. And his servant said to him, Behold, there is a woman that hath a familiar spirit at Endor. And Saul disguised himself and put on other raiment, and he went and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night. And he said, I pray thee, divine unto me by the familiar spirit, and bring me him up whom I shall name unto thee. And the woman said unto him, Behold, thou knowest what Saul hath done, how he hath cut off those that have familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. Wherefore then layest thou a snare for my life to cause me to die? And Saul swore to her by the Lord, saying, As the Lord liveth, there shall be no punishment happen to thee for this thing. Then said the woman, Whom shall I bring up unto thee? And he said, Bring me up Samuel. And when the woman saw Samuel, she cried with a loud voice. And the woman spoke to Saul, saying, Why hast thou deceived me? For thou art Saul. And the king said unto her, Be not afraid, for what sawest thou? And she said, An old man cometh up, and he is covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel. Of course, I know you're getting this. Samuel is the dead prophet, and this is the ghostly shade of him evoked from the murky afterlife by the witch of Endor. And Saul stopped with his face to the ground and bowed himself. And Samuel said to Saul, Why hast thou disquieted me to bring me up? And Saul answered, I am sore distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God is departed from me, and answereth me no more, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called thee, that thou mayest make known unto me what I shall do. Then said Samuel, but here I'm doing a soundbite truncation, The Lord hath rent the kingdom out of thine hand, and given it to thy neighbor, even to David, because thou obeyedst not the voice of the Lord. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with thee into the hands of the Philistines, and tomorrow shalt thou and thy sons be with me. Meaning, dead as doornails. Only that's not an exact translation. The Lord also shall deliver the host of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. Then Saul fell straightway all along on the earth and was sore afraid because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no bread all the day nor all the night. And the woman, the witch of Endor, mind, came unto Saul and saw that he was sorely troubled and said unto him, Behold, thine handmaid hath obeyed thy voice, and I have put my life in my hand, and have hearkened unto thy words which thou spokest unto me. Now therefore, I pray thee, hearken thou also unto the voice of thine handmaid, and let me set a morsel of bread before thee, and eat, that thou mayest have strength when thou goest on thy way. But he refused and said, I will not eat. But his servants, together with the woman, compelled him, and he hearkened unto their voice. So he arose from the earth and sat upon the bed, and the woman had a fat calf in the house, and she hastened and killed it, and took flour and kneaded it, and did bake unleavened bread thereof. And she brought it before Saul and before his servants, and they did eat. Then they rose up and went away that night. End of transcription. And the next day, David is persuaded to quit the battle by an argument that I can't quite follow. But Saul joins with the Philistines and meets the end foretold by him through the ghostly apparition of the dead prophet Samuel, thanks to the agency and magic of the witch of Endor. Though in fact, depending on which report you trust, Saul is not slain, but slays himself. He sees doom approaching, and he falls upon his own sword. In other words, he makes the witch's prophecy come true himself, partly by believing it. And Saul dies, and so do his three sons, including Jonathan. And at the beginning of the second book of Samuel, where we shall leave David, he is lamenting over Saul and over Jonathan in those famous phrases, How are the mighty fallen? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. Now, it's taken a long time to get to the witch, I'll admit. But her story means squat without knowing of the mortification of King Saul. Without the history of the nation of Israel at stake, this old hag could never have wandered out of prehistory to perform common tasks, such as making bread and comforting wandering soldiers, and, when asked, summoning up the ghost of a dead prophet. There are several ways to regard her. She is, for one thing, an outlaw. She is practicing a trade that has been forbidden. She is not herself a qualified prophet. She isn't Samuel. She doesn't read the future. Samuel, remember, was the prophet who foretold Saul's coronation and from his own grave, Saul's death. Samuel is Marley to Saul's unredeemable Scrooge. But who is the witch? She is an operator, a go-between, perhaps just another perverse, rebellious woman. She has nothing to say on her own except, Here, have a little bread. Go on. Let me do up a little calf's liver. It's an old family recipe. You'll love it. Put your feet up. Take a load off. Only that's not an exact translation. The Witch of Endor is not a soothsayer. She is not the Delphic Oracle, muttering mysterious puzzles that will come true one way or the other, depending on how you look at them. She is not Cassandra, rushing about the ramparts of Troy, fecklessly predicting the city's doom because she's been cursed by Apollo with the fate of being accurate but unconvincing. The Witch of Endor does not read the stars to see how fate must befall a king born under them. It is not recorded that she bothers to spill the entrails of the calf when she cooks it, to do a cross-check of her own augury by reading the liver and spleen. No, indeed. She is a humble woman, and almost assuredly an older woman, given her apparent skill at this difficult art. And truth be told, she probably raises spirits from the dead, because at her age it's easier than taking in laundry. According to Edith Dean's All of the Women of the Bible, quote, modern writers have dubbed her the Witch of Endor. Lord Byron has called her the Phantom Seer. Kipling gives one of the most vivid portrayals of all in these lines. Oh, the road to Endor is the oldest road and the craziest road of all. Straight it runs to the witch's abode, as it did in the days of Saul. And nothing has changed of the sorrow in store for such as go down the road to Endor. Edith Dean also points out that, quote, in her magic, she broke laws that had been set down for the people of Israel. In Leviticus 19:31 is this strong admonition, regard not them that have familiar spirits, neither seek after wizards to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God. Dean also clarifies about Saul, quote, the road he traveled led 6 miles southeast of Nazareth, on the outskirts of Endor, were many ancient caves. Now, the cave may have been very dark, as Dean implies, hanging with animal skins, and perhaps needing the improving hand of some sort of Bronze Age parlor maid. But I, for one, do not believe that the Witch of Endor could be in any doubt that it was King Saul who came before her from the very moment he entered her company that dark evening. I believe that her very first utterance, referring to the prohibition reinforced by Saul himself, was her way of saying, you don't fool me. My tongue can be loaned to the voices of the dead, but my eyes are my own, and I can see through your ruse. She gives him a chance to reveal himself, for only in his own honesty can she help him. How can you read the future of someone you don't know? Northrop Frye thinks that the Witch of Endor scene is slapstick, that she really is Oda Mae Brown from Ghost. Quote, the summoning of Tiresias from Hades in Odyssey 11 has a biblical parallel in the story of the invoking of Samuel by the Witch of Endor at the behest of King Saul. The contrast with the Homeric scene is more striking than the resemblance. The witch, says Northrop Frye, is clearly accustomed to the vague entities that drift through her world, ready to claim any identity suggested to them, and there is a sardonic humor in showing her how demoralized she is by seeing real gods or spirits rising from below the earth, including what appears to be the authentic ghost of Samuel. I adore Northrop Frye, but here I think he's off his meds. He contradicts his own assessment elsewhere of the grave psychological crisis of an abjectly collapsing king. Quote, in the Witch of Endor scene, Saul finally turns to the occult powers that he himself had forbidden consultation with, and disaster and death follow. The terrible and inevitable degeneration will remind the modern reader that Shakespeare must have studied the account of Saul with considerable care before writing Macbeth. Close quote. To which I add, yes, and King Lear, too, for the tale of the consumption of a mad hero by his own household, in a sense. My copy of the King James Version of the first book of Samuel also has William Faulkner's fingerprints, muddy with the red soil of Yucknapatawpha County, all over it, and they won't wipe off. Deirdre Levinson, from The Psychopathology of King Paul, reminds us, after his encounter with the Witch of Endor, Saul, quote, experiences all the terror of his godforsaken condition. Yet he goes into battle the following day and dies in the role he was appointed for, fighting in Israel's defense. The people of Jabesh-Gilead, hearing what the exultant Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night to retrieve his mutilated body and the bodies of his sons, because it was in the defense of Jabesh-Gilead that Saul mobilized the concerted manpower of Israel and Judah to fight the first battle of his reign and gloriously won it. So, what a function the Witch of Endor plays. A small role, a medium, a go-between, who helps God tell God's divine plan through the ghost of Samuel to a king whose time is just about over Tivka Friar Kensky, in Reading the Women of the Bible, comments, quote, "A standard work on pre-biblical Mesopotamian religion remarks that one of the most prominent mythical themes in that period seems to be the descent to the lower world. The lower world is the world of the dead, but not of simple death. There is always some sense of a surviving and continuous form of existence, a kingdom of the dead, however vague or insubstantial. It resembles the Greek Hades more closely than the hell developed later in Christian theology." We know about this theme of the descent to the underworld from humanity's oldest written narrative, the Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh. We feel very smart knowing this already. Kensky goes on, "The Witch of Endor is not an evil woman. Quite the contrary. The necromancer is presented as good and generous. Her ability to communicate with spirits does not make her evil. Her craft is outlawed because it is an uncontrollable and ungovernable access to divine knowledge. But it is effective, and it can be benevolent. Like the more legitimate prophets, the necromancer is a channel for contact with divine power. The necromancer has the terrible task of channeling an announcement of doom, but she can at least give Saul the courage and strength to face it." Close quote. When I review my own initial dramatic problem, who is Yackel, and why can't she die? I think, who was there to predict for the Witch of Endor her own death? Who was there to tell her that her part in the consolation of Saul was also part of the divine plan? Not nobody, not know-how, unless the God of the Israelites spoke to her directly. But eyewitnesses failed to report this, herself included. Let us have a glancing look left and right before we're done. Off to one side, the historic side, we note another soothsayer, a medium more famous in her time than the Witch of Endor. They worked their magic simultaneously. The Oracle of Delphi. She plied her trade about 800 miles to the west. Let us glance at the aspects in common, the cave, the voice of the divine, the agency of the female in communicating that voice, and the urgency of political history, be it of the Greek city-states or of the tribes of Israel. The standard text on the Delphic Oracle by Park and Wormel asserts, "For 1,000 years of recorded history, the Greeks and Romans, sometimes as private individuals, sometimes as official ambassadors, came to Delphi to consult the prophetess, known as the Pythia. Her words were taken to reveal the will of the gods." I'll summarize their lengthy conclusions for you. The oracles at Delphi, we can conclude, could manage up to 4 functions, sometimes simultaneously, though it is not recorded by history if they could also twirl a lighted baton while delivering themselves of their perorations. They could, 1, foretell the future, though with maddening ambiguity, thus revealing the divine purpose or the will of the gods. 2, they could advise, like MapQuest, on the best route to take to achieve one's destination, however ill-considered it might be. 3, they could serve as international arbitrators, a kind of Condoleezza Rice of the Attic world. Or 4, they could serve as father confessor, though since the Delphic Oracle was female, we can assume that she was merely a kind of administrative assistant for Apollo, who was usually in a board meeting somewhere trying to persuade Zeus to stop humping the cows, even though with, quote, all their silken flanks with garlands dressed, as Keats put it, the cows could seem quite fetching, even coquettish. The Witch of Endor only manages one of these 4 Delphic functions, to be God's mouthpiece about the future, thus revealing the divine will of Yahweh. But listen to what Park and Wormel say about the femininity of the oracle at Delphi. It's worth it to hear it in their words. Quote, "This use of a female mouthpiece does not seem to be typical of Apolline divination. The simplest explanation seems to be found in the previous worship of the goddess Gaia in the same place. Clearly, her chief ministrant would have been a woman. And if, as is alleged by our authorities, Gaia had issued prophecies, it would have been through a woman's mouth. An interesting analogy is suggested by an oracle of Gaia, which survived in late classical times at Egira, just across the Corinthian Gulf. There, a priestess of Gaia, used to descend into a cavern and return inspired with prophecy. The motive underlying the method was no doubt a belief that by entering a cavern, the servant of the goddess came into closer contact with the divine. This conjunction of a cult of Gaia, a center of divination, and the cavern occurs again north at Olympia, where the worship of the earth goddess had preceded that of Zeus, and a cavern mouth. The persistence of the tradition that the Pythia, the Delphic oracle, sat above a cleft or entered a cavern points to some similar ritual, which, as we may suppose, was originally employed by a priestess of Gaia at Delphi in the second millennium BC. So, it is the woman in the cave who can know the plan of God and foretell it, perhaps because the cave itself is merely a pocket of the larger world, as the woman with her feminine powers is herself a cave from which new life and new history is brought forth. The Witch of Endor is likely to be beyond childbearing age, but her access to the ghost of Samuel is perhaps related to her access to the earth, to the fecundity represented by Persephone, underground half the year, and fecund and life-giving, which has to mean history-bearing the other half of the year. Before we leave the witch to her story, let us look in the other direction, not at the historic parallels, but in a larger literary sense about what those who dabble in this sort of enterprise are usually up to. In the epics, which are nearly always stories about men, about warriors and kings, and the establishment or destruction of tribes and nations, the oracles predict success or failure in battle. Samuel himself, a prophet and possessed of the Spirit of the Lord, predicts Saul's rise, as we have seen. In the fairy tales, though, in the household tales of humble hearth and sheepfold and gnarly woods, the predictions are nearly always made by wise women or mad women, and nearly always made to women or to men young enough to be womanly in their capacity for mercy. And why do women go to the magic pool or seek the advice of magic mirrors or talking frogs or crones in the forest bearing bundles of sticks upon their backs? Because they want to know how to get pregnant, that's why. The men ask, when will I die? And the women ask, when will I be reborn in a child of my own womb? Men ask about the end of history, and women ask about the beginning of it. Look what I started with. I have an oracle named Yakel who cannot die. Unlike what the Witch of Endor communicates from Samuel to Saul, knowing both the day and the hour of Saul's timely end, Yakel cannot die. She even makes an effort at it uselessly. But now I see what I have done, mucking about rather brainlessly with the common material of myth, as is my wont. There are only a few elements in the Witch of Endor story, but they all appear, quite accidentally, in my fictional pages. There is the imminence of death. There is work to be done or work to be aborted, always the case when death gets involved. There is the issue of food and feeding, both ritually and for nourishment. And there is the question of who is in thrall to whom. But just as deeply, my funky little episode called Deposition of an Oracle is about the shifting of power in Oz from the throne of the wizard to the next young strapling with a slingshot, the son of a witch named Lear. It is, too, about divine providence and divine disapproval, and about how reading the future is only possible if you know how to read the past. Yakel, in begging to go into her own crypt, has gone into the cave, like Saul when David might have killed him, remember? Like Saul when he visited the Witch of Endor? The Delphic oracle prophesied from a cave, effectively. What is a cave really but a womb, the womb of the earth, a fissure from which knowledge emerges? Who is in thrall to whom? We know of the death of the prophet Samuel, though he lives on in the Old Testament books bearing his name. We know of the death of old King Saul. We know of the death of Jonathan, born of the perverse, rebellious woman and beloved of David. But what do we know about the death of the Witch of Endor? So now I can guess why Yakel cannot die in a crypt. She must not go underground like the kings, the prophets, like Tiresias of Hades, like Samuel. At the end of Deposition of an Oracle, she, Yakel, yet another perverse, rebellious woman, will disappear into the pages of the Grimmery, a magical book of Oz. Literally, she will move there, substantially, not in a cave nor in a grave, but in a section of a book. She will wait for us there, for Elphaba, for Lear, for history to find her. For the Witch of Endor, you see, has not died. She never goes into the ground like Saul. A rebellious and perverse woman, she is not important enough to die in battle. So she works her magic still, not from the shadowy cave, but from the cleft gutter made by two pages of a book spread open, waiting, ripe, moist, succulent, fertile, endlessly renewable, full of life for all comers. Her voice still speaks. Death will come sooner or later, she says. Meanwhile, sit, sit, eat something. I'll roast a leg of lamb, she says. Take comfort in the company of your mortal companions, the lovely and sacred and beloved, side by side with the perverse and rebellious, she says. Only that's not an exact translation. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture by author Gregory Maguire titled The Witch of Endor, Reading the Future. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies at Boston University. Mr. Maguire was introduced by Luce Program Director Peter Hawkins. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog, with help from Matt Odette and Michelle Tash. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.